everywhere hello after Big Fish. My father would say that I entered every cathedral from Lisbon to Prague. Bounding across Christendom to confer with God and all his saints, I climbed bell towers to debate with angels, lighting candles in 100 kingdoms to comfort the dead, delivering my father's prayers to heaven by hand. The truth is, before I left for Europe, I asked him what he wanted me to bring back. My father said he had enough souvenirs to last this lifetime. He asked only one simple thing, with a half smile on his face. Stop in every church you see and pray. Just go in, even for a minute, and say hello. Dad, I said, you know Europe is full of churches, right? You asked me what I wanted, and this is what I want, he laughed. And so it was that I went to Europe and stopped at every church I saw. Hola, at the Sagrada Familia. Nada. Bonjour, at Notre Dame. Silence. Ciao, at the Basilica di San Pietro. Una pausa. And in that pause, I heard, hello, hello, hello. Everywhere, hello. I went abroad to bring my father a gift. Instead, he taught me how to say hello before he said goodbye.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Renzo del Castillo, and I'm joined, as always, by the amazing, three-teed, not toad, but teed, Scott Raven. How are you, Scott?
That is great. I'm currently wearing three camisas, and I am, T-cubed this evening. Luckily, the air conditioning is working, and I'm ready to discuss a great film with a great person that we're going to intro just in a sec. We got a big fish here tonight. We got someone that I can't wait for our audience to meet. The one, the only, Mei Ling Perez.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be here with the two of you tonight.
And we're happy to have you. Would you mind if I give a little bit of an introduction? I worked really hard on it.
Absolutely not. Please go ahead.
Okay. Tonight, we are joined by a poet whose story begins with imagination as survival. Mei Ling Perez was born in a small town near Havana, Cuba, where growing up cut off from the world meant creating your own. She started writing at 7, and in 1994, immigrated to Miami, carrying that same creative force while building a career in finance, banker by day, always in love with literature. Her debut collection, Amar, Perder y Renacer, moves through love, loss, and rebirth, with rich imagery and a through line of kintsugi, the Japanese idea that what's broken can return even more valuable. It's a book for anyone who's given their heart away and come back stronger. Mei Ling, welcome to Real Poets. We're inviting you to keep it real with us, and you've chosen Big Fish. So we're really excited to dive into that with you. And unlike Scott, that dive in wasn't meant to be a pun. So
it may have been, but really,
I'm excited
nice
as well. I can't wait to get into this film with you guys. I can't wait to see where your imagination went as you either watched the film for the first time or rewatched the film. I'm not sure.
Well,
in talking with
Scott, I thought our film was going to be Enter the Dragon. Why would he think that would be our film?
Isn't that interesting, Scott, huh? So it turns out my father was a big Bruce Lee fan, and he picked Enter the Dragon as the movie to grab my name out of. So growing up in Cuba, I always say, guys, there's no baby books with names. You make up a name, and we all know how those may sound like. You get a Chinese name, a Russian name, and if you're lucky, maybe a name from your great-grandparents from Spain. So my father was slightly creative. He went with a Chinese name, and it's been rather interesting to go through life from folks trying to do business with me because they think I'm Asian, to a marriage proposal at a point in time because they also thought I was an Asian woman in Miami.
Interesting. Now, so do you find yourself having to go into the name origin story every time, or are you at the point where you make up other explanations for your name? Have you done that ever, or it's always like, all right, this is the what's
you
behind
know,
it?
I haven't made one up yet. I thought that I really like this one. It's been fun. It's been interesting. I have tried to learn Mandarin just so I could add a little flair to the story. I hate to admit I have miserably failed at that, but but it was fun to take a few classes with Rosetta Stone.
Which I find then, because a name then does become a portal into maybe another culture's identity and source of information. I told you, my son Banzai, and neither my wife or I, have Japanese or Chinese origins. But it makes me more and more, we have our connections to that. In any event, we will not be moving like water with martial artists, but we'll be moving into the water with some Big Fish tonight.
And can we, why Big Fish? Nothing against it. It's just, I'm always curious as to why our guests choose the movies that they choose.
Yeah, so Big Fish, out of all the films I've loved and liked, I never thought Big Fish would be top 10. But when Scott approached me with the idea of doing this podcast, it was just a movie that I had seen once. It had stayed with me. It had left so much emotion in me more than the film itself. And I just thought it was such a great intersection of reality, of myth. And I think that's kind of where poetry lies, right at that intersection of those two. And I went ahead and I rewatched the film, and I was kind of blown away by it altogether. So for me, it couldn't have been a better pick. And I can't wait to dive into it with you guys.
For the benefit of our audience, I'm just going to give a quick synopsis, maybe a couple of key credits and some trivia. Let's see if I can stump you guys. So Edward Bloom recounts his life through fantastical, exaggerated stories that blur reality and myth. His son Will struggles with the absence of factual truth, seeking to understand the real man behind the legends. As Edward approaches death, Will learns to participate in the storytelling, discovering that emotional truth can hold more weight than literal accuracy. And that's a concept I really want to dig into with you guys. Directed by Tim Burton. I have gone on record as saying I think this is the film where Tim Burton matured. There's a definite shift in the way that his storytelling evolves. Screenplay by John August. It's based on Big Fish, a novel of mythic proportions. The cast is Ewan McGregor as young Ed, Albert Finney as older Ed, Billy Crudup as the son, Jessica Lange as his wife, and Marion Cotillard as Billy Crudup's wife. Music, as always, or almost always, by Danny Elfman. And, it's The town of Spectre in the film was built as a full set and allowed to decay before it was restored. I don't know if you guys knew that. The giant Carl was portrayed practically, not with CGI. And it's a thematic departure from Tim Burton's darker gothic style, which was interesting, even though it's still there, but it was a bit different this time. So just wanted to lay that out so that everybody knows what we're referring to and talking about.
So I know you added some fun facts there. I have one of my own as I was digging into the
Yes.
film. Did you know that Daniel Wallace, which is who wrote the book in which the film was made of, he made a cameo in the film itself. So he is Sandra's economics professor when she's in the school, and Edward Bloom is professing his love at Auburn University. So Daniel Wallace is in the film. I thought that was neat.
Wonderful. Oh, I have to go back and check that out.
I would like to see. Do you know if he's written any other movies that have been, or books that have been adapted to film? Or
Oh gosh, that I don't know. I don't
I
know.
wonder if there is something else. I mean, yeah,
I can
like his
research
style as
that while you
well.
guys chat.
Yeah. And there's some deviation between that. Well, I know the film, it starts with a literal, well, or a fish story of a big fish. I wanted to ask if you've ever been fishing. Have you ever gone fishing, maybe with a parent or?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I have. So my dad was raised by his aunt and her husband, and he was big into fishing. So he would take me fishing all the time. As far back as I could remember, I was probably 3 years old when I remember being in this little, let's call it a dinghy, and this is in Cuba, of course. And he would take me out, and he was just big into how the moon and the tides, and he there was a whole science around it, and I was just more into talking. So I just remember him telling me often, I love you so much, but I don't think I could keep bringing you out. You talk too much. This is not good for fishing.
Wow.
It happened a few times, and it came from a place of a lot of love. I think it
Yeah,
gets maybe a little lost in translation, but I just remember I was not good for his fishing. It was a good
that's
memory for me.
hilarious.
I'm not sure how much fish we took home every time I went out with him.
Right. So more equipped to tell fish tales than to actually, to fish.
Absolutely.
That's great. Yeah, because I remember early, like first hearing even just that term of, I caught a fish this big, and like processing that, what you make of that when you are little, what you make of that when you're older. I fished with my cousin once before, and then I had a real memorable experience ice fishing
Oh, that's fun.
in Winnipeg, Canada. And then to your point, where it really was just sitting in negative 40 degree weather with inside a hole, and you're just patiently waiting to get a bite, and it became exhilarating when you did get a bite on the line. But just the fact of going out onto like a frozen lake, just the kind of mix of emotions that come out with that. So yeah, I Renzo, you never fished.
Not a fisher person, not a fisher king either. I live in Edgewater here in Miami, and which is right by the Venetian Causeway, and I see a lot of people fishing all the time. My cousins have always fished. I just Unless we're gonna eat it, I don't see the point,
We
right?
ate it. We ate the ice
Well,
fish.
we,
Or no, I'm
we
not.
did too.
It's not a judgment call on you guys. I'm saying me, because I wasn't gonna clean that guy, that sucker, right? But there's I've been around fishing. I've cast. I've never done it. But you mentioned your dad. But is he the reason that you wanted to watch Big Fish? Do you have an Edward Bloom in your life, Mei Ling?
I actually have an Edward Bloom in my life. It's not my father. It's actually my grandfather. It's just funny that you bring that up. As I was watching the film, so my grandfather's been that. I think we all have that one very interesting person in our lives, and he's been that for me and our family. And he relates to everything through stories. But this guy was a guy that went on to just third grade, youngest of 14 siblings. Worked for the circus, was a magician, was a forensic photographer at a point in time, was a reader for like the tobacco farmers, helped my mother with medical books when she was in dental school. So he's just such a collection of stories. Actually, him and my grandmother fell in love when he gave her tickets to his magic show. So, I mean, as I watched this film, there was just so much connections that I don't think I ever made when I saw it the first time. So, yeah, my grandfather's definitely the big fish in my life.
And having a person, maybe the most interesting man in the world for you, right? Having
He
a
is.
person of that magnitude, of a personality of that magnitude, as you're
Yes.
describing, how did that impact your artistic career, how you write, how you tell stories throughout your poetry?
So I think both my grandfather and my grandmother were drivers when it came to me writing. My grandmother was a big reader, she still is. And my grandfather's just great with words. I actually have a folder on my phone where I save all the little messages that he sends me, and it's just poetry all the time. It doesn't matter what it is. It could just be, I haven't heard from you in 2 days, and it just sounds like this long lost love letter from overseas. It's just the way he expresses himself. So I think that growing up around creative folks that loved language and words, and that was a big impact just in my life altogether. Like, we communicated through stories. It was just not only a function of my family, but I think it was a function of my culture. I joke about this all the time. I mean, in Cuba, there's not a lot of ways to entertain yourself. So storytelling is at the core of everything that we do.
Then how does that play a role in your book? I found it interesting when I was reading the description of your book. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I will get one.
Okay.
You will have to sign it. I will get
I'm
one.
sending
And
it.
there was the way that you described it, like kintsugi, right? Like this healing process, and that the scars make you more valuable. That's where the gold plating is when you mend something. I wrote my book when I was going through a difficult period of my life. And I've mentioned this before, but when I thought life had stopped giving me things and started taking them away, a lot of people I loved died, a lot of opportunities I had went away. And it was just a way for me to heal. So can you tell us a little bit about how your book came about?
So I've liked writing for as long as I can remember, but I never really saw myself writing poetry. I thought of doing novels and children's books, and I wrote a little bit of music, but never really poetry. And it was during a difficult time, very much probably what you went through as well, where I feel like the book started to write itself. I always say, like, imagination, creativity knocks on your door. You just have to open the door and let it in. I can't say that I was, it's almost like something was channeling through me when I was writing that book. And it was a coping mechanism. I had been diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder. My partner at the time fled at the thought of hearing that this was even happening before he even understanding what was going on, before I even knew what was going on. And because writing was just such a big part of my life, I took to my notebooks. I mean, if you look around my house right now, there's notebooks everywhere. I do try to keep them organized. I'm looking at a stack right over there. And I took to just writing, and it was my way to reflect, my way to cope, my therapy, all in one. And then at some point, I decided that this needed to become a book. At some point, I decided that after going through such a difficult time, I needed to do something that scared me. And that thing that scared me was putting this book out there. So the book is Amar, Perder y Renacer, so love, loss, and rebirth. And it takes you through all those three stages, and it's segmented in such way. And it's just that journey that we go through, whether it's a first love, whether it's a long lost love, whether it's friendship. And then when you get into that loss phase, you know, it's those feelings when you feel like you're deep in a hole, right? But the beauty of how the book ends with rebirth is that I think any point in my life, whether it's love related, family related, career struggles, every time that you go through those periods of time where you're kind of down in that hole, there's this fire that we have. I mean, as humans, we have this ability to rebuild, that come back stronger. And ending the book on that high note was really important to me because I think that's kind of how I felt at the end of that journey.
So a little meta action there, where the writing of the book was the form of the rebirth. Was there an added element of you're putting this book out, but you were giving readings? I know you at Books and Books, you actually did have the release. Had you done that before as well, like shared the poems aloud frequently, or this was
No, not
more
at
first
all.
for you?
So I, you know, in general, I'm very sociable. I love to talk. I could talk to a wall if it allows me to. But I tend to be very private, especially as it comes to like emotions and feelings. And it was also the reason I think I loved writing, because for me, writing was a way to put everything I felt into paper instead of sometimes being vulnerable and sharing deep emotions. So it was a full rebirth for me, not just on coping through the loss, the emotional loss, or coping through the loss of health, quote unquote, at that point in time, but it was a full rebirth of pushing through things that scared me. And that's really what that creative period of my life did for me. It wasn't just putting my work out there, but it was also, now that I'm ready to put out my work, let me do all these things that terrify me, because I think life could change so quickly on you. So why not push through all these things that scare you? And it was, I have to tell you, Scott, it was the most amazing experience of my life. Absolutely terrifying. I've never been so scared, but it was also so rewarding. And for me, as I joined like this, my book, my baby, I call it my little baby elephant because it took so long to get it done. It definitely was not 9 months. As I put my little baby out into the world, there's so many people that you connect with, because there's so many folks that are at a point of their creative journey. They're questioning themselves, they're unsure, they're stuck. They don't think they could do it, and it was just such a force, at least for me, something that I wanted to do for me, and something that I think I connected in so many ways with the people that came to my talks and the people that I was able to meet and talk to.
Yeah, wonderful. If we bring it a little bit back to the film, the one poet, of course, in the movie, is kind of stuck. He's unable to get out of this little, whether you call it a paradise or just a land of contentment. The character played by Steve Buscemi, what's
Norther
the poet's
Winslow.
name officially? Norther Winslow.
Northern Winslow. What
Which
a
I guess
name.
ties a little into a little bit of a thematic question of, do you need the breakdown? Do you need the dark with which to create? Do you need things to somewhat fall apart in order to draw from? Maybe not fall apart, but can you write effectively just from a place of love, or just from a place of yeah, let's say status quo and contentment. I'd love to hear each of you on that a little bit.
I think there's magic in all sides of it, right? I think you could write from a place of happiness, from static, from just being, whether it's in love or excitement or the birth of your new child or parenthood or family. I think you could write from a place like that, but we have to realize that life includes all a wide range of emotions. So I think that the human experience has this wide range of emotions that, for example, in my book, as I brought it out to be, love, loss, and rebirth, it's just part of our human experience. So to write from a one-dimensional standpoint, for me, it's not a, I feel like it would be lacking so many important elements that we experience every day. That's just my take on it.
I'd have to agree for the most part. I think that's where empathy and imagination comes in. But imagination, at least in my view, is brought about by experience. So when I think about Norther Winslow, I think he is the film's clearest statement on poetry. So Inspector, which is the town that Ed walks into as a young man, he is a poet. Norther Winslow is a poet who has weak work. Wasn't Roses are red, violets are blue. I love Spectre. Not even a how about you,
Those are
right? Like I
great. Yeah.
exactly,
And it was
right?
what, 12 years in the making, I think it was.
Yeah, it was 12 years in the making. I mean,
Yes.
it's sentimental, but it's static, right? And I think that Spectre itself represents culture, I mean, comfort without growth. So I think that the film lacks links bad poetry with stagnation. When he leaves Spectre, when Ed encounters him on his sales route later in life, when he's middle-aged, Norther Winslow is a bank robber. So he's engaging with consequences, reality, risk. Later, he's a millionaire. So I guess he evolves and adapts and transforms. Whether you find being a millionaire to be the pinnacle of creativity or not, the guy went from not being one to being one. And I think that means the arc is symbolic, not necessarily literal, right? Like the real crime is breaking out of passivity, and the wealth is lived experience converted into value. So what I think and again, Scott, I know you have some different thoughts on this, but what I think that the film is saying is poetry without lived experience is hollow, right? Poetry requires friction. It requires risk. It requires transformation, where Winslow is the cautionary tale and Edward is that realized version of a storyteller slash poet. But Scotty, you had some thoughts on this.
I mean, I guess because my experience is slightly inverted, like I'm starting out as the artist, okay, and trying to make a go, make money through my art, and I achieve that. And then whether that's sustainable or not, even living my dreams, there is an element that becomes specter-like. There is an element of, all right, I'm performing around the world, but I get to, maybe I'm performing the same five poems. There comes a point where I'm not necessarily being challenged enough. And, I look at it as to, all right, what could I do to be more of an artist? And not to speak ill of, but so many people start off a career of arts and then abandon it for something more secure, right? And God bless those that are able to balance both, but some leave it forever, And I wonder, could he have uplifted the town of Spectre, Usemi? Could he have found some way in? Did he sell out, but maintain any, like, where is the artist within him? I'd like to hear from you too of is there a point when you like hook the more secure route out of a fear or out of no, out of I guess reality check.
That's a big question. So I think I
Sure.
agree with both of you. I think Northern Winslow is that dreamer that's stuck in a comfortable place, right? He's stagnant. He tries to break out. He's pursuing creativity, but then there's that struggle between art and practicality, right? And then in his case, I think he kind of lets go of the art and practicality wins versus we see Edward Bloom being a poet the entire film, and he's creating his own story through magic. So I think there's that contrast in the film. I think I absolutely have struggled with that. I have to tie a lot of what's happened in my life to my story because that's really the core of who we are. And as an immigrant kid who came here at 11, with two parents that left everything, practicality becomes very important, right? You have to go to college. You have to get a master's degree. At a point in time, I was in law school. You have to do as much as you can do just to validate the fact that your parents have left everything to give you a better life. So that was and has been a big challenge for me, right? How do I balance this creative little girl who was writing for as long as I could remember? That was such a dreamer with this person that has had to kind of uphold this pressure of being an immigrant and grown in corporate America and follow that traditional route. And that, Scott, I would say I don't have the magic formula, but it's been a balancing act my entire life. I think my soul needs art, my soul needs creativity. In different ways. I mean, one day I'm in a ceramic class, the other day I'm painting. I am terrible at painting, I will admit. The other day I'm doing glass blowing. I think it's a way in which I sustain what I would say is that inner fire. But then in the world that I live in and in the situation that I was in when I came to the States, I had to be realistic, quote unquote. So yeah, it's a
Right.
challenge.
Now, do you, what I've tried often when I've taken jobs within, whether it's a teaching realm or some other jobs, is how can I infuse my creativity into those jobs? Like I can't even exist in that realm if I don't have a chance to be creative. I just don't function as me. There's a separation. Have you found ways to bring even what you're passionate about into your work life, or is it like a severance kind of thing where it's like, all right, I'm almost a different person in some of these other realms?
Gosh, I think that so they always say that men are able to compartmentalize better than women, but in this case, I've had to compartmentalize. I think it's just a separate category altogether. I mean, who I am and my personality and the way I see the world, I can differentiate those two, but it's very hard to bring art and poetry into wealth management and lending and finances as much as I would like to. So I have had to keep those separate. And I enjoy both worlds. It's not that there's not a place where they could coexist, but in my particular experience, I have kept those two separately.
Right. But I'm sure even just your interactions with people there, bring your warm personality, and your intelligence, and with just to date it with people, I'd imagine.
Well, the beautiful thing about what I do, and I say now as we're talking through it, where I could say there is that overlap is I hear stories all the time. So I connect on stories. I was saying earlier, I come from a family that loves to tell stories. I come from a culture where stories are at the core of everything that we do. So interacting with folks in my day-to-day job, that's all I hear, right? Like stories. I like to get to know why you are who you are. What is it that made you that way? What makes you tick? And that's really what I hope that sometimes when people are reading my work, they understand what makes them tick or what was it that they read that just resonated with them.
The only thing I wanted to add, because I think you asked me the question too, is I was 11 in 94 too, right? But I came here in 89 when I was
Okay.
younger.
A little younger.
Yeah, a little younger. And I also had that weight of responsibility. And it played a different role with me because as a kid, I feel like I was kind of a victim of that male disease of thinking that you're worth is predicated on what you can achieve as opposed to who you
A
are, right?
gatherer.
And then when you have that immigrant mentality that we are responsible for our parents' legacy because they sacrificed everything to be here,
Absolutely, yeah.
until I came to a point where I was like, yo, you made that choice. Thank you very much. But I'm not like I'm my own life. Yes, like it's part of who I am, but I also need to look for what makes me happy. And I went to school for aerospace engineering. I was 4 credits short of graduating, and then I switched to poetry. And I had scholarships that I got on my own, so my parents had no say. And I've told this story before, I think, but you can imagine what the Thanksgiving slash Christmas break was like when I
Oh,
made
yeah.
that choice, right? And they were just, what I know now is that they were fear-based. They loved me and they were afraid of that I wasn't going to be successful, that I was, I mean, they had a narrative that they were told about the United States and what it takes to succeed, right? And I think that was informed by, after World War II, the monarchy was dead. The UK old kingdoms needed money. They leased or sold all of these telegraph lines that they had all the way down to South America to the US. And what did we get? American dream, come work for us. Because when the economy is booming, we want cheap labor. So come, the US, American dream, come over here and take it. And then when the economy goes down, oh, it's the immigrants' fault. Get out. So you have this narrative that is instilled in countries like Cuba or Peru, where I'm from, Argentina, where my cousins are from, Chile. I mean, everywhere in South America, where it's like you go to the US, you do the thing, you get the grades, you get the scholarships, you get the degree, you get the job. I graduated for the first time from grad school in 2009. That was the year of the bubble. Nobody I went to school with did anything they went to school for, right? So it shocks you in terms of that narrative. So when as I mentioned, I went to school for aerospace engineering and I switched to poetry, and that was the one time that I chose the not, like the scary thing, right? And I got into Cambridge and I was going to go for grad school and for a summer program, and I was going to turn that into grad school. And because I was my immigration situation at the time was I had political asylum and I came in with a student visa. It was really pretty soon after September 11th. I was going to say the world was different then, but it's pretty similar to what it is now in terms of the immigration situation. And my parents talked to, I knew two people that got deported, even though they weren't terrorists, but the people who came to blow up the towers had student visas, right? So, I mean, there was a lot to unpack there. And my parents came and talked to me and said, how about you finish here and then you can go do whatever you want? And I said, okay. And I finished here. I did communications because it was, for me, a perfect intersection of the things that I loved about engineering and poetry. So when I graduated, I mentioned I graduated that year and I made good money, but not steady money as a freelancer. And I thought that there were two industries that benefit from inefficiency in the US, healthcare and law. The worse you are at it, the more money they throw at it. And I'd lived in Miami, which Florida is the capital of fraud, waste, and abuse, right? So I'm like, okay, I can get some money here. And I forgot about poetry for a long time because I didn't have it the idealized way I wanted it. And I was miserable. I was very successful and I was miserable. Until I realized a good friend of mine told me to follow my passions. As a recovering people pleaser, I couldn't answer his question because it was always in relation to someone else. Until I dated myself, figured out what I like to do, how I like to do it on my own terms. And poetry came back that way. So, Scott, to answer your question, it's a slippery slope, right? In terms of like, what do you do? Did I sell out? Yeah, I like my Egyptian cotton sheets touching my skin before I go to bed, right? I like my nice things. But I also, don't have like the art for me. I'm lucky enough that I've built enough of a foundation through skill and through luck, because you can't guarantee opportunities coming your way, that I can be creative and have the financial backing to allow myself to be creative, right? As opposed to just like finding a way to make creativity fill my coffers. But
I just always had the belief that you could do both. And that's
we
not
are.
coming from So, we're speaking on the other side of it. I know I'm a parent now. That do you feel with the youth of America and the young people in your life, you would offer up the same approach, that of balancing, or go for your passion go for do what you love, no matter what.
So, two things. First of all, let's not overlook the fact that you have made a career out of being a touring poet and done it successfully for a number of years. You have children now, so you're changing that up, but you're still a touring poet, right? So you found a way to make it possible. That's number one. Number two, you and I, shout out to the KB Poetry Share in the city of Key Biscayne, just did an event, a workshop with children in Key Biscayne for Earth Day, where we had the support of the parents to have them read poetry and to explore that. And we're not necessarily saying like poetry is going to make you rich. What we're saying is poetry is going to enrich your life, right? It allows you to communicate, it
Correct.
allows you to build bonds. I don't, so Mei Ling, when I like, I'm a pretty successful person in the corporate world, right? I was a VP for big companies. Now I'm a leadership in a consult in a boutique consulting firm on my own terms. I have poet as maybe the number one or the number two thing on my bio in LinkedIn. That was a thing that I debated because I had this narrative in my head like, if you put poet, then they're not going to take you seriously. But at this point, promoting my book and promoting this podcast and doing a number of other podcasts and shows and whatever, I talk about, like, they ask me, are you Renzo the executive or are you Renzo the poet? And I'm like, I'm Renzo. I am me in everything that I do because poetry breeds about empathy because it's an analytical relationship between yourself and an object. You start thinking about what the artist thought when they created whatever they created. You use that for problem solving. You use that for team building. It's everywhere. Like poetry is everywhere. There's just this, in my opinion, this myth, to bring it back to the movie, that poetry is something that is for a select few, for the elite. But movies, everybody loves. Why do you think we do real poets? Movies have a framework of communicating ideas and passions and art. Poems do the same thing. It's just one thing is mise-en-scène, another thing is a villanelle, right? But it's still a mechanism for conducting that and putting that forward. So what would I tell the children, Scott? Yeah, go for it. Go for it because life finds a way, brother. Like you can still write while trying to figure out how to put food on your table. You can still build something while you can figure out how to take care of your family. Don't put limits on yourself. I won't do it. Enough people are going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
I think you could only ignore your passion for so long. So I think it's important to give it the time of day because one way or another is going to break out. And Renzo, I agree with you. I think that I used to be a little shy, and that's why it was such a fear thing for me when my book came out there. And then I had colleagues and I had clients and I had everybody come in. And there was this part of me, just exactly as you're saying, that said, "Ooh, am I less of a professional in this realm if I do this?" And then at some point, I just became so comfortable with the fact that I've never found myself to be a one-dimensional person. So why do I have to be in that sense? I mean, there's so many layers to us, and it just makes us a lot more well-rounded to have all these passions and bring them all together. So yeah, that was, you said that so beautifully.
Well, I have a question for both of you.
Okay, we're ready.
We were just talking about the narratives we tell ourselves, right? In terms of like, if you're a poet, you're not going to be taken seriously. If you're an artist, and vice versa, or can somebody that's very corporate create art, right? To bring it back to the movie, do you think to write a good poem, to tell a good story, to communicate, how important is the truth? How important is facts? Is there truth in the myth more that will act more accurately represent event or the emotional core of it than you would if you just dictate it in terms of what actually happened?
So I mentioned that I wanted to share with you guys, and I could just summarize it, something that I wrote, and this is not the poem that I'll share at the end, as to why I thought this movie was so important. And it kind of touches on that, and it also touches on kind of those of us that belong in between. So if you let me, I'll just read this briefly. I promise I won't take too long.
Well, there's some fees involved, so we'll talk
I'll put
offline.
it on my tab.
Take too long. Take an
No.
extra minute of just breath.
Yeah. We gotta keep bonsai in baseballs these days, so yeah. No,
Let's do
please,
it.
by all
Okay.
means, we would
So
love to hear what inspired you to.
I think I want to touch on both things. This is going to touch both on like reality, and then it's going to touch on people that live in the in-betweens, right? So there's people that live their lives in facts, and there's people who live them in stories. I think I've always belonged somewhere in between, and that's why I love writing. When I thought about a film to bring into this poetry, the space of poetry and cinema, my mind really wandered back to Big Fish. The film I had seen once, as I shared with you guys earlier, yet somehow it had stayed with me. Maybe because it doesn't ask you to believe the story, it asks you to feel it. Big Fish, to me, overall, guys, is a question. What if who we are isn't found in the facts that we list, but in the stories that we dare to tell? There's something deeply human about wanting to be remembered. And wanting to remember not just what happened, which goes back to your question, Renzo, but how it felt. Brighter, bigger, a little more beautiful than reality may have allowed at that moment in time. Because poetry in my mind, it's not so much about accuracy, but about essence. So then maybe us poets, us three here, we're a little bit like Edward Bloom. We soften the edges, we add color where there was pain. We turn ordinary moments into something almost magical, not to deceive, but to survive. And poetry for me does exactly the same.
Oh,
Thank
yeah.
you for sharing that, Mei Ling. What about you, Scott? Because you're someone who I know
Wow.
values truth, but you love to play around.
I love the word play and the flowery language. So you shared kind of your collegiate tales. I don't know if I've shared on the podcast that, like our main character, I went to school for journalism. I was actually a journalism major.
Communications and
And
journalism school right here.
hey now.
UF, baby.
And granted, I was like my beat became film and poetry though within it. At first, it was like talking to people. And whenever I'm writing a piece though, like I try to have a basis of truth. I try to find the factual information behind whatever topic that I'm exploring. I mix that in, then the next thing is finding the personal connection. Speaking to what Mei Ling is, where can I find the heart of it? What, no matter what we're talking about, what is my personal connection? And that's the space where the truth can be somewhat bended. Whether it's hyperbole, like I got a poem about all my greatest fears that you recently heard, and some are ridiculous, but it's just to show like the balance of silly and serious. But I remember, that I was this journalism major, and it came a point where I wanted to be able to make up stories. Like there was an element of telling stories, but like so many poems, I do feel lack imagination, that they are somewhat presentation of facts, and I like there to be both imagination and truth within a poem. I mean, it's to me what separates, yeah, maybe a diary entry between what is presented for a wider audience. One of my famous poems is me turning into a chicken, like eating so much chicken that I turn into a chicken. And it is me larger than life. And I will say this, when I first started performing, I feel I was a more exaggerated version of myself on stage. And as I've grown and as I've performed more and more, I now feel I'm a more authentic representation of who I am, even in front of others in a stage, where I feel comfortable sharing the mundane and the everyday as much as sharing the extravagant, the deep, and that sort of thing. I know that was a little all over the place, but real quick, getting back to the jobs. Right out of college, I had an interview with, like, I think the CEO of the Trenton Times. It was like a huge paper, and like nobody gets a meeting with her. My cousin somehow had organized it, and I had like 2 minutes with this woman, and I asked her is whether she loved her job, and there was a moment of hesitation, and like, she couldn't have gotten there if she didn't have an aspect of love, but I realized, like, that moment, like, all right, it wasn't really for me, and like I just, all right, carve my own path right after that sort of thing.
You know, I'm still struggling with that because I'm someone who has said, like I've said these words. I go into art, truth matters. Like I go to art to find truth, right? But what is truth? Like, yeah, you have an act, you can get the facts or you can exaggerate them, but when I look at Big Fish, I see Ed represents the myth. And his son represents facts, right? And it's also like this inheritance. Like I honestly think Big Fish is more about inheritance than anything else, even more than about truth and myth, right? Like this, does the myth in like beget the facts? And then why do they have this? It's almost as if I forget the kid's name or the man's name, but it's like he feels cheated by the inauthenticity of what he believes his father is. He's like, I don't know you. I don't know you. I'm about to be a father and I don't know you. And in the final moments when his father's dying and all he's asking him is to tell his story, right? This legacy. He becomes the storyteller. And I don't even know if it's forgiveness or authorship. Like I don't know what happens there, right? But what I do know is that when you get the prologue, or when you get the ending, his son is now telling this story and he's like, it happened this way, right, Dad? And he's like, yep, that's how I told it. So not except for the final moment, you don't see him telling these big yarns, but it is implied that he is the one who passed these stories on to his son. Right. So I'm still struggling with, I think the world needs truth. I feel like there's too many opinions in terms of like I don't want to talk about vaccines or anything of the sort, but like, oh yeah, here, like this is the scientific fact, but this is my feeling on it. Right. I think that I personally think that we have the right to our informed opinion. I don't think we have our right to our uninformed opinion and then putting that on others. But I can't reconcile that with still having like a parable have more truth than a news story. You know what I mean? So I'm still struggling with that.
I mean, I think that struggle is at the core of the movie, right? So the son wants fact, the dad wants magic, the dad wants the myth, and there's this moment where I think the son finally learns how his dad has been loving him all this time. And I think it's really not till that final scene where he partakes and he finishes the story for him, right? And I think he realizes that sometimes love speaks in symbols and in exaggeration, and it doesn't make it any less because it's not as factual as he originally wanted it to be.
Well, it was the scene with the doctor played by Robert Guillaume, Rafiki, right? Where he
Robert
says,
Guillaume.
Robert Guillaume, he tells him, like, do you know the story of when you were born? And he's like, yeah, my dad was wrestling with a big fish and all this stuff, and he missed my birth because of that. He's like, do you know the real story? And he tells him the story. And actually, that was the scene that inspired my poem today, right? He tells him the story. The actual story was this, like, your dad was just en route. He couldn't make it in time, and he was really sad. He's like, if it were me, I like the story where he was struggling to get back to you, right? And I think that, and then right after his father has that moment where he's going to pass away, right? How does it happen? Albert Finney's fantastic in this for an Irishman with that southern drawl that he has in this one, just that voice that he has, like amazing.
And his name's Finney, so it looks wonderful.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, it happens right before that scene, and then we get this beautiful scene of reconciliation, but it's still open-ended, like for me at least. Like he came to peace with it, but it's, I don't know if truth is still as important to him, or will it be, because it seems to be part of his nature. So I don't
Can
know.
we say, well, in some categories, truth is needed, and in other realms it isn't. You know, like maybe in terms of life and death, love, I will say, you know, like has kind of an ethereal quality that it isn't always grounded in truth. You know, like if I'm to speak a little bit, you know, my wife, I love her so much. We're quite different, but in our, I guess, connection to language and art, but our values are so aligned. When you strip all of the fanfare and like the like me being extrovert, her being introvert down, there is such a similarity. You know what movie this really reminded me of a lot too was Moulin Rouge,
I love
and
Moulin Rouge.
you know. Right, and it's also Ewan McGregor playing like a similar character, but like how kind of like it's a more fantastical love story, but it's really just the guy, you know, kind of writing
Elton John songs, right?
The thing with the film though is that I feel like I almost look at it the other way. I almost feel like there is so much happening in the world, right? There is so much truth. Whatever that truth may be, right? But there's so much pain, so much hurt. And my question for the film is like, do we all need to be a little bit more like Edward Bloom and bring more magic into our lives, right? Because the bigger question for me is like, how are people on a day-to-day rewriting their stories to survive, to thrive, to deal with pain, to deal with trauma? Like, I think that here's this guy, who was an actor in his own life, right? He was a poet. He every tale that he says is really like it could be a standalone poet on his poetry on its own. And how is he creating this magical world to deal with the mundane, the fact that he's a door-to-door salesman selling these robotic arms? Did you guys see those? Those are not fun to sell. So like
Shout out
how
to Edward
he
Scissorhands.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, how many people want their paper to be like held on by this little robotic arms? So he is rewriting
I
his
feel
life.
Scott would buy one. I feel Scott would buy one.
Oh yeah, the power glove as
Yeah.
well. Oh yeah, and yes, right. I love what you're saying. The evil side of it or whatever is you know isn't that religion though to a degree for some, but. Where that becomes the magic for others, and some get whether corrupted by it or and nothing to slight those that really get something out of religion. I always say poetry is my religion. Either you're right or you're wrong. No, but like it just the idea of yeah, this world, the circus, yeah, like the circus of life, to live poetically rather than to just be a poet, to live poetically, how can we do that?
Well, Danny DeVito scratching his face with his own foot was the one part of the movie where I laughed out loud. But I something Mei Ling said resonated with me, because I feel the opposite. I feel that the world needs truth. I feel that there's so many narratives that are false narratives that we're forgetting. Like someone committed this thing, but people that follow these people are like, no, but they meant this or they meant that, right? Like as an example, I don't want to get political, right? But you mentioned religion. So we have the president of the United States posting a photo of himself as Jesus after criticizing the Catholic Church. When called out on it by his followers who are evangelical, because it's nobody else, he's going to say, no, how only the fake news is going to say that that's Jesus. This is obviously a Red Cross doctor. And now all the memes I see online are just like people from ER or people from Scrubs or people from the pit dressed like Jesus. right? It's just like, what is happening in terms of like what the truth is or what narrative is? And I only bring that up because of religion. The other thing I'll say, I think the perfect example that we can actually deconstruct is Santa Claus, right? Santa Claus has become a cultural icon, more than Christianity, more than Christendom. He's known,
Oh, don't
right?
ruin it for me. Okay.
No, but like Santa Claus, I'm not going to ruin it. I have nephews. I don't like to lie to them. I try to explain things to them when they ask me, why does it rain? Because my parents, when I was a kid, told me, oh, that's angels going pee-pee. And then I had an existential crisis at the age of 3 crying when it rained because I was like, no one pees on me. No one pees on me. Right? So I'm like, yeah, because the water condenses and blah, 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 blah. But I do. And Noah's 11. The twins are 7. Noah's older. And I still maintain the myth of Santa Claus with him because I think it's important for him to believe that there is an entity in this world that is giving. And then when he's going to start asking questions, which I'm pretty sure it's going to be soon, I'm going to hit him with the fact that, well, we are all Santa Claus. We are Santa Claus, right? Like, let me unlock this other layer. And that's myth, right? And I know that I'm not being exactly honest. I could be like, you think that old man bought that toy for you? I bought that toy for you, right? But I think that's where I can truly see the Edward Blum of it all, right? Like, I'd rather believe in magic where little kids around the world are given something just for being little kids, for being good, I guess. You know, we can get into that whole like define what is good and what is bad, but
Right. Well,
Scott, you have some
but do you
thoughts.
want it? Well, do you want it to be a commercialized version that sells more Coca-Cola? No, or do you want it to be your own mythology within your own family too? Like it,
Yeah,
instead of it being
the
Santa
second.
Claus, Hanukkah Harry, or like, all right, like you make up your own mythical creatures, even, like my son, we talked every animal on the street right now, like Mr. Chicken. It's, like, are these like that? They all have their own little backstories. I love being able to be being able to do. It's just when it becomes like, yeah, like Santa Claus, there's just so many, there's so many holes within it because of how many you see, and because of, like you can pop a map. Why is Santa one race and not another race? Like, it's just hard to. I think what we could all agree on as poets, and what Mei Ling had mentioned, is the emotional truth of things. How can we get to the emotional truth of any manner? And what is an emotional truth? What is an emotional truth that is accepted, that we are all, that we're born, we die, we fall in love, we get our hearts broken? Like, what's an emotional?
Well, I'll leave you with this story because I want to hear Maylene answer, but I want to give her this context. Did I ever tell you about the time I got kicked out of catechism school? Scott?
Are you asking me?
Yeah,
You
because Maylene, I just met
osmosisly
everybody. So
told her? Yeah.
so
I
no,
have not heard the story.
so I was a voracious reader as a kid. Like, I learned how to read like at 2 years old. I was reading like The Count of Monte Cristo at 7 or 8, right? Like, I was a voracious, voracious reader. So I had my first communion. I grew up Catholic, and then I was in catechism school for my confirmation. Well, my catechist, Victor, I still remember him, he was not there that day, and it was one of the nuns. They were talking about the Holy Trinity that day. They were asking the question, how can the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, three separate entities, be one God? And of course, I was that annoying kid who sat in the front of the class and just raised my, I was like, me. I had been reading about psychological disorders recently. So I said, schizophrenia. That penguin turned red immediately. Okay. She picked me up. In Spanish, it's el cien. I don't know how to say it in English, but like right here by the temple, the hair on the temple, and shoved me out of class. They got the Bishop of Miami, his name was Oscar Urantome, to come and deal with it. And Victor came in and they said, oh, Like, you don't know this kid. He wasn't being disrespectful. Like, he's a really smart kid, whatever. And my parents came back and said, congratulations, they'll let you back into CCD. And I'm like, no. And I refused. That was
I'm
one of the
done.
few times I refused. Here's the issue. If they would have answered the way Victor would have answered, which was, it's a question of faith. Do you believe that these three entities exist in one? Right? It's faith. It's what you can't touch, what you can't see. Like, this concept of three entities being one, that's what faith is. Like, believe what you can't see. But she heard something that she considered disrespectful because she couldn't defend it. So she let her reaction be fear-based. And I thought that any religion that defended themselves based on fear was nothing I wanted to have anything to do with, which is my break with the Catholic Church started at 11 years old, right? So it was just that. I love the fact that if you get past the part where they're stoning people for not doing what they want them to do, there's a message of love in there that's still like that exists at the same time the other things exist. And I think that's beautiful, right? But it's for me, the problem is when you have myth being manipulated by mankind to get something. That's where I have a problem with it. That's where I think the myth is a danger.
Does faith play a part in your life at all, Mei Ling?
I mean, I grew up very Catholic, but I had some similar situations to you, Renzo, where I was a bit of can I say smart ass here? A bit of a smart ass growing up. I'm more of a spiritual person now than anything else. But when I hear everything that you're saying on like the truth part, on what we need to bring more into the world, but I kind of go back to the film and I see this guy who grew up in a little town who just had fears, right? Like that was a giant. He was scared. He needed to break out. He needed to go into something else. And the fact that the stories is what kept them going, I just think of I think of me as a little girl, right? In a place where there was nothing. There was nothing to eat. There was no toys. There was all I felt and all I dealt with was stories. I grew up on stories. I grew up on magic. And I think that without that magic, I think that kids, we shrink a little without that magic. And maybe it's kind of the romantic in me. I mean, I do write romantic poetry, right? But I think we need that magic as humans, as a species, to get us through so many things. And a lot of the times we don't recognize the importance of that.
Yeah.
For whatever that is, whether it's legacy, whether it's survival, whether it's just preserving our nature, ourselves, our family, I just think that's so important.
I
Now, well, can things be too sugar-coated with
Absolutely.
so
Oh, yeah. Oh,
right. So that the other end
absolutely.
is it doesn't become people, it doesn't make you prepared enough to how heartbreaking and cruel the world can be. And that would be my only critique of the film at times, that some of the, I guess some of the darker edges, well, I guess you have the witch a little bit, you know, are kind of they're danced around a little bit too much even into his adulthood, where you know, we can talk about the affair, whether or not
Yeah,
he
that's
did
what
or
I want
did
to
not
talk about.
have, and right.
That's what I want to talk about, because you bringing up the witch is something I want to dive into, and then I think we should get to the poetry. But I will say this. I have been known to say magic is just science that hasn't been explained yet, but I've also been known to saying that I don't want to live in a world without magic.
Well,
Right. So
I
I
try to
understand
explain
that
most.
dichotomy.
I try to explain most things through science as well, but I'm with you 100%. I had not heard anybody else say it that way too, so I
Yeah.
fully understand.
Oh,
And
yeah. I
you
always
know,
meant
and
the show.
sorry, Scott, the film, I mean, you see Tim Burton, right? Like he's done darker. And then this is like that magical realism. And by the way, as I was reading into the film, his dad was actually ill as he was doing this film. And I don't know if his dad actually passes away before the film is done. So it was a deeply personal film to him as he was going through this on a personal level too.
I didn't know that. Yeah.
I didn't know that either, but it makes sense. So let's talk about the affair or the potential affair. Here we have a scene where Billy Crudup's character travels and he finds the witch, which is actually the little girl, right? Because the witch is, when Ed would tell the story about living life fearlessly, it's because when he was a boy, the witch showed him his death in a glass eye and he's like, oh, that's how I die. So I'm just going to go live my life because I know that I'm safe, right? Which is a way, which is using the myth to explain that he lives his life. The truth is, he lives his life without fear, as if it's his last. Okay. Then in the town of Spectre, there was this little girl who grew up, and Billy Crudup goes to travel because he finds that his dad owns that place. And he talks to her, and the first thing he asks her is, did you have an affair with my father? And she's like, oh, you're going to go straight there, knowing she's expecting the question, right? And in the movie, what it shows is that he was there to fix the town. She would hold out. So he just stayed there until she gave in to him. And she said, I wanted to be as important to him as you. But for your, he's like, so you were the witch, but you're the little girl. He's like, yeah, to your father, I was the same thing because there were two types of women for Edward, your mother and everyone else. So it implies that, oh, he was always faithful to his wife. But we also know from the movie that he preferred the romanticized version of the truth, the romanticized version of his failings. So maybe he was unfaithful to his wife. It's just that he always kept coming back. I think I don't want him to be unfaithful to his wife because they have such a beautiful love story. She like the older version, like the way Jessica Lange plays the love that she has for him is fantastic. But he probably was unfaithful to his wife. I'd like not to believe it, but something tells me he was. I don't know how you guys feel about it.
Oh, that's, I don't know. That's a big question mark because I think that the one thing that kind of ties all the scenes in the movie together is love. If you think about even the beginning of the film, the only way to catch the fish in my eyes being Edward, is the ring, right? So it's like this ring is symbolizing the only thing that could catch this wild animal, right? So there's a lot of distortion in the film, there's a lot of exaggeration, there's a lot of symbolism, but I feel like that love that he has with his wife is rather constant. And there's this beautiful scene almost towards the end of the movie where they like lay on a tub together and it's just they're just embracing and it just feels like such pure love, but it could be. I mean, he's spending all this time in this town helping this pretty girl fix her house. It could have happened.
Well,
You're
go ahead,
less
Scott.
inclined to believe someone who exaggerates if their values are not aligned, if their values are not in order. So yes, I will agree with Mei Ling. Like you can almost have you can stretch the truth more if you are a person of great character. And I the you know the one contradiction is, yes, if those that know the book, I think it is made maybe clear that there is an affair in the book. But the in terms of this screenplay, it leans towards what Mei Ling says. It hinges on this love story that it's not, and I hadn't thought of that before, but the rest of the movie doesn't really hold water. If that is an indiscretion.
Well, here's what I'll say to that. Yes, in the myth, but the myths were created because he was an absentee father. That's not a lie. That's why the kid doesn't know him. That doesn't give him great character, right? Maybe he was working, but he was an absentee father. By definition, if he was an absentee father, he was an absentee husband. So he showed up and it was great, but and she loved him and they have great time together and all that stuff. But the myth is there because it's better than the truth. And that's like, and I believe that the emotional truth is that he loved no one, maybe himself, but he loved no one more than his wife. I do think that the myth is so aggrandized with the proposal with the daffodils and working 5 years for this. And yeah, There's something to that because the truth was not good enough. And if the
Mm-hmm.
truth wasn't good enough, I believe that that was the underpinning. He'd rather have that story. So that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah,
Sort of
I think it's,
I still think his love
and that's
for
the
her
darkness of Tim Burton. That's where I'm like, that's where the darkness is for me, right?
There could be a little bit of darkness there. I still think that his love was unwavering for his wife. And, you know, I just go back to that scene. There was nothing. That was the most simple scene in the entire movie. And it was beautiful. And it was
And
probably the most real scene that they showed us from his life.
yeah, I think so too. And to be fair, when you see the funeral scene and the son is looking at it, he starts seeing the giant. He sees the twins, but they're not conjoined, right? He sees the people from.
And who they're with, the poet,
with
actually.
Northern Winslow.
With Northern
I think one of
Winslow.
them's his partner at the end of it, right?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
So there's the element of truth in the myth. They do make it a point to show that at the very end. Well, would you guys like to read some poetry? But before we do that, any final thoughts on Big Fish?
I mean, I think in general, there was a line in a movie that said, a man tells his story so many times, he becomes the stories. There's just something to be said about the legacy that he did create for his family, whether we could agree that maybe a little bit more truth was necessary, and the ability for his son to learn to love him in a language that he was speaking, right? Which was storytelling, which was, in general, to me, it was poetry.
Yeah, that scene wrecked me. Yeah, Scotty.
Yes, second time seeing this film, first time in the theater. And the one point that I was hinging on a little bit, that it wasn't, you know, it didn't have some of the darker edges when I had first seen that, I remember thinking that. But now I guess I'm okay with it. I'm viewing it a little bit generationally now too, as Renzo had pointed out, you know, where you've had that final scene with him and his son in the water, and that he has passed that on to his son. And, you know, I'm thinking quite a bit of that. And I mean, I mentioned in my book the you know, when talking about the movie Life is Beautiful, and the kind of the connections of, all right, you know, how much do you stretch the truth or avoid the truth, especially when talking to young people, but when they're getting older, if your child's personality wants the cold hard truth of things, I think you meet them halfway. You meet them where they are. And I don't know if his dad did that. He came to his dad. He came a little bit further to his dad's side.
Yeah,
definitely.
So I almost feel like, all right, you know, meet when you're both two adults, meet each other at that midpoint. That's all I'll say.
I think Big Fish isn't asking if the stories are true. I think it's asking if truth alone is enough, right? I think the film draws a line. I think the storyteller, poet that never leaves specter, that never leaves comfort, dies there. And you heard me mention that I think imagination is brought about by experience. Northern Winslow didn't leave specter until he saw Ed leave specter first, right? So I think that that is a very big telling sign. And I think that poetry that risks something becomes alive. The worst poetry in the film comes from people who haven't lived yet. And I think that's what Big Fish is saying. So, without further ado, Why don't we read some poems from the film? So, Scott, normally I know you like the whole sandwich thing with the guest in the middle. Is that what
Yes,
we're gonna do today?
yeah,
that
let's,
what
I
we're
mean,
doing?
I've got a couple pieces that are ones that's in the works, one that might be a little more finished. We can feel it out. There's a couple. I want to I had one more question too. What was the longest you've ever worked on a poem? Just speaking for Northern Winslow, where it took him 12 years. What is the longest that you've ever worked on a single piece? I'm curious for each of you.
Oh gosh. I don't think I know what's the longest. I know I've started, I've put it away, I've randomly ran into the notebook and then I restarted. I don't think I've like taken track of how long, what was that time period between one or the other. I've also experienced the other side of it where I wrote something that I probably
A
hated at
flash.
the time, put it away, ran into it maybe 2 years later and thought, wow, who was this? I like this. So I think it really depends where you are in that moment, where you are in your life when you're reading poetry. That's why I think it's so, that's why I'm in love with it so much, because two, three different people could see it in so many different lights.
Months for me.
Months.
But it was Ars Poetica, the poem I did based on Howl for this podcast. It was less, it just so happened that Howl helped unlock it, but I was thinking about an Ars Poetica for months. I didn't write anything, but it was in my head. Like the way that I tend to edit my poems are I just think about them and when they're ready, they just come out. I don't typically edit too much either. So it just I know that one took months and I don't remember one that took longer than that.
I think because there's the idea of the truth of something won't reveal itself sometimes when you first sit down to write it, like you when you're too close to something, like you can't, it won't come out until it's ready to come out, as you're saying. Where some poems can take years, or you can do the same one that will come out, in a flash. But there's poems I've worked on for years, I will still say, and I always have like four in my head still swimming around.
I feel you guys are so lucky that it's all being built in your head. I have to write and rewrite and write again. There's just something that happens with the touching of the paper and the pen, and
No,
I
I need
can't
that as
seem to
well.
do it on a computer either. I
No,
have to
it's
write it out.
oh, you gotta
It's just
hand
the
write.
way,
Hand write's great.
it's just the way our brains work, right? Like that's just how it is. It's no better or worse. It's just different. It's just different.
I think it's a whole experience for me. It's just not the same if I'm not writing it out several times.
Yeah, no, I gotta write it out too, often.
Sometimes I have to write it out,
I
but
like to
again, like
type
my
it and then write over it a lot.
But my brain, I can't help it. My brain already put it out there. It's already formed. Like the second I want to grab the pen or the second I want to grab the keyboard, it's
It's
there.
ready to go. It's great.
So Scotty, do you want to kick us off or you want
Yes.
me to? Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
Okay.
let me try one of these.
I have two as well,
That
but I'll stick to one.
no, do what you want to
No,
do, man.
we want to hear it. We'll hear them both. So I'll do one now, and then we'll come back to it too. Maybe I have another
I only
one.
have
All right, this
one,
one.
you overachievers. Just one.
Show-offs.
All right, let's try. This was a concept that I was trying to explore for a bit. Here we go. Can somebody introduce me for a second?
Yeah, coming out from New York, Scott Raven with his poem entitled.
Thank you. I'm feeling a little overconfident tonight. This is my bazillionth time performing, and I'm pretty sure you're going to shit yourself when you hear this fire I'm about to spit. I know, I've just started, but I'm surprised you haven't all died laughing. Wow, what a crowd. Get ready to be amused and confused, even mildly aroused. You have an in or out of body experience with this poem, while I promise the other half of your minds will be sufficiently blown. I've been doing this so long, I've really got nothing to prove. But still prepare to fill those empty drink glasses with actual tears from being so goddamn moved. No offense to you guys and gals out there, but this crowd, it's embarrassingly small. I can't remember the last time I wasn't rocking out at some sold-out stadium or packed concert hall. But believe it or not, this is not the smallest crowd I've ever performed for. The smallest crowd I ever performed for was a bunch of ants. No, not a slew of mom and dad, sister siblings, or who your uncle's having sex with on any given day, but for a bunch of literal insects in my driveway. And I bombed. In my defense, the first 20 minutes had an entire army of them lined up in front of my Ford Tempo squirting ketchup packets, and then someone must have spilled a drop of wine or something because they were drunk, and so they, of course, heckled, and it hurt my feelings. Like, a lot. At that point, I tried to change the direction of my set. So about 30, 35 minutes in, I stepped to the side and I squashed 100 of those little bastards. So in the end, I guess I kind of killed, right? Jokes aside, sometimes we'd travel hundreds of miles on a red eye and be forced to swallow our pride having arrived at a college for a crowd of four or five, which may or may not have included the people putting on the event. Sure, we were getting paid by the programming board who hired us for the event, and we'd give it our all every time, regardless of who was there to receive it. Traveling such a distance took its toll. Was it really worth it to spend 8 hours on a plane away from family and friends to share something I wrote for just a handful of people? I started to phase out touring colleges to spend half the year teaching. On the other hand, the largest crowd I ever performed for was a cluster of sumo wrestlers somewhere in Japan. Or maybe it was during a lightning storm for a few gods and goddesses up on Olympus when Zeus became our biggest fan. Actually, it was in Houston, Texas, for 4,200 middle school students. Oh, yeah. My poetry group and a breakdancing collective by the name of Ill Styles and Peace were the co-headliners who had the privilege of following one of the greatest pitchers of all time, Roger Clemens. And Roger gave a riveting speech on how to succeed in life and how he managed to do all this without using any performing-enhancing steroids. Which made me wonder, was it more important for Roger to feed 5,000 adolescents an inspiring message that might ripple across the generation of youth who looked up to him, or him to do some serious soul-searching and actually tell the truth? A few years later, I put aside chasing crowds of thousands to teach a class of eight. Eight of the most brilliant, creative, beautiful souls with infinite amounts of talent and heart, each on the autism spectrum with varying needs of support. The strangest crowd I ever performed for was for a bunch of inmates in Lancaster, California, who were riveted by our words and stunned into silence. The youngest crowd? Depends on when you feel life begins. Because it was either for my pregnant wife, a bunch of toddlers at a museum in Harlem, or my newborn son. Ask me now if I prefer a big crowd or a little crowd. Today, it's just an audience of one.
Love it.
Yay. It's an audience of two now.
I love it. This is quite the audience of two today.
Hey, Mei-Ling, would you? Two chills.
Yeah. Would you please bless the mic, Mei-Ling?
I will. I'm not quite sure how to follow that now.
Do you go ahead and follow that?
All right, here we go. Okay. So I'll just go straight to it. A life told plain would fade with time, but wrapped in wonder, it starts to shine. Big Fish reminds us gently, almost in disguise, that truth can live behind brighter eyes. We stretch our moments, we make them glow. We turn quiet endings into something bold. For stories aren't just the things that we say, they're how we choose to live our days. And where we're gone, what will remain is not the facts, but the feelings we gave.
Thank you for sharing that, Mei-Ling.
You're welcome.
Well, I wrote a poem. I wrote a poem. Nick Frastic. It's called Everywhere Hello, after Big Fish. My father would say that I entered every cathedral from Lisbon to Prague. Bounding across Christendom to confer with God and all his saints, I climbed bell towers to debate with angels, lighting candles in 100 kingdoms to comfort the dead, delivering my father's prayers to heaven by hand. The truth is, before I left for Europe, I asked him what he wanted me to bring back. My father said he had enough souvenirs to last this lifetime. He asked only one simple thing, with a half smile on his face. Stop in every church you see and pray. Just go in, even for a minute, and say hello. Dad, I said, you know Europe is full of churches, right? You asked me what I wanted, and this is what I want, he laughed. And so it was that I went to Europe and stopped at every church I saw. Hola, at the Sagrada Familia. Nada. Bonjour, at Notre Dame. Silence. Ciao, at the Basilica di San Pietro. Una pausa. And in that pause, I heard, hello, hello, hello. Everywhere, hello. I went abroad to bring my father a gift. Instead, he taught me how to say hello before he said goodbye.
Oh boy, wow, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
Shalom.
L'chaim.
Yeah, well, hello and goodbye. Aloha. Hello and goodbye. yeah, I love it. I was thinking, you know, initially of writing a piece, you know, called Small Fish of
That's
like,
right.
But what I'd like to hear from each of you too is like, what are some simple pleasures in your life of things that you really enjoy doing that are mundane and small, that aren't intention seeking or like something that you would post on a feed?
Yeah.
Is there one or two that do come to mind? Of just real simple pleasures for yourselves.
I have so many, and your questions almost right on cue. So every year I try to do some kind of creative project, and it's not just writing. So this year, God willing, at the end of the year, I want to do a photography exhibit called Simple Pleasures and all that it entails. But for me, so I've thought about this a lot, and if I had to pick two, my two simple pleasures are a cup of warm tea, just holding on to it, just meditating into the warmth, into like just the smells, everything that entails to like sip on a cup of warm tea. And another simple pleasure of mine is just dipping my toes like in the sand. That just like, it's mind blowing to me how small little things could just change your day. So that's two out of many.
Watching the Atlanta Hawks. No, I'm kidding, buddy. I'm going for the Knicks. I'm going for the Knicks.
Oh.
I'm going for the Knicks. You know this. Simple pleasures.
Yes.
You know what? I love sipping kombucha. I love kombucha. I like cold drinks more than warm drinks, even though I love tea. Watching a James Bond movie. Well, I'll post about that, so maybe not. No, I really do enjoy writing. Like, I do enjoy just sitting down and creating. Not everything gets posted. Writing for myself, writing for others, helping somebody out. Like, I love a simple pleasure is like if I get a phone call from a friend saying, hey, could you hear me out? And I love hearing them out. I love communicating. You know, I love creating connection. So that and kombucha.
Which can become more complex depending on where the conversation goes, I guess. Mm-hmm. But
the beginning of it, right? Just
how about for you, Scott?
Yeah.
What are yours?
Like sitting under a tree, if I can. I like taking a train without a destination, sometimes just to get on, maybe to write or just to get on and then go back. You know, I right now every day walking bonsai to daycare. I'll tell this story because it just happened today, but we pass the Cheetos truck just every day, and we met the driver finally, the guy that drives the Cheetos truck, and he gave my son a high five. And today the guy's his he was coming out of the store, and his boxes flew everywhere. And I walked over and I like grabbed some of his boxes and helped him put on. And then the guy saw us and he's like, "Oh, hey, you're the guys that always say hello." And he gave us a high, high five again. And then we're walking away, and he ran after us and handed us a bag of Cheetos. And like he's like, "Cheetos from the Cheetos man." And I just never smiled so much in my life. And and Banzai did the same. And one for Banzai, one for Echo. But it was just, one bag of Cheetos, and we just shared it on a playground, me and him after school, which was great.
Just lots of little things.
I just want to call to attention for our listeners because they can't see this, but Scott is actually such a dad that he's wearing a pacifier as a ring right now.
You noticed that?
I'm
Wow.
glad you did. I thought I would call it out, but I didn't
I
know
mean,
if
I
I was
didn't.
allowed
That's
to.
like dad level 10. There's
I didn't even
he's just ready
realize.
to. It's jewelry. It looks good with the fit, and he also can pop it in.
It's fused with my finger next to my wedding ring. Yeah, that's it.
Well, I just want to take a moment, Mei Ling, and thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing so much of your story, sharing this movie with us. I really enjoyed it. It's not one that I would have picked again, and I had such a great time watching it. And I just want to sincerely express that gratitude. And also, I wanted to give you a chance to plug anything you're working on. You mentioned an exhibition you're working on for the end of the year. Where can people find you on the social, right? Like, tell us a little bit about what you're doing, or where people can find your work.
Oh,
And if you'd like
absolutely.
to leave us with another poem as well,
Of
please.
course.
Oh, I mean, I could read the second one. I
Okay.
have no problem doing that. Guys, if you keep me talking, I'll be here all night. So I don't know
Yeah,
how many
we'll
spouses, children, and significant others I need to apologize to. But
No.
so yeah, just working on a creative exhibition, hopefully by the end of the year, but nothing set yet. So that's more to come. And you could find me at Mei Ling Perez on Instagram. My book is out there, Amar, Perder y Renacer. No, I am not translating the book. I get asked that question a lot. I feel like this was written in my native tongue and it's staying there. There's just some things that are lost in translation for me. But I am doing some writing in English, so more to come there.
And
Nothing is a set
we
date.
can find it on Amazon and local bookstores in Miami, like Books and
You
Book.
can find it on Amazon. Yes, it's available on Amazon.
Is there a website? I know that you have a website for you as an author, right?
I do have a website. It would probably be too long for me to share the website on the podcast, but the best way is just to find me on Instagram or find the book on Amazon.
Perfect. And then would you bless the mic one more time?
Okay, great. All right, here we go, guys. All right. And let me know when you're ready.
No, I was just giving a, I was acknowledging Scott.
Right. In fields of daffodils, love learns to wait. Golden and endless, defying fate. A giant walks where fear once stood, teaching the heart what's misunderstood. A small town hums in timeless dreams where nothing is ever quite what it seems. A circus spins under midnight skies where destiny hides its quiet disguise. Big fish whispers low through every tale that truth may bend, but it won't grow pale. For stories are rivers we step inside, carrying memory, love, and pride. And when life slips like a fish from our hands, it is the stories that stay that help us understand.
Thank you again, Mei Ling. That was beautiful. And
Thank you.
I am Renzo del Castillo, as always, joined by Scott Raven. And this has been Real Poets. As always, Scotty, you want to send them home with the catchphrase, the future t-shirt? Oh, your sound is done, so I'm going to say it for you. Always keep it real.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.